by visiting www.freedombox.info.
Serotech Corporation and ACB Radio Interactive have joined forces to give you several exciting chances to win your very own Freedom Box. Stay tuned to ACB Radio Interactive to find out how to get your name in the draw and how you can bring a relative or friend online absolutely free. At least two lucky winners will walk away with copies of the Freedom Box software worth $99 each. And one lucky winner will win the grand prize, the Freedom Box Standalone Edition, currently retailing for $999. Plus, all packages include 1 year's free subscription to the Freedom Box Network. And that's not all. We want to bring someone who's not computer savvy online. So if the winner of the Standalone Edition donates that box to an offline friend or family member, Serotech will throw in an extra Freedom Box software package for the original winner completely free.
When you hear the Freedom Box login sound,
you're logged on.
Followed by a song with the word freedom in the title, get your name in the draw by sending your name and phone number via email to freedom@acbradio.org. That's the sound.
You're logged on.
Immediately followed by a track with the word freedom in the title.
Contestants are subject to ACB Radio Interactive contest rules as found on the ACB Radio Interactive website at interactive.acbradio.org. Freedom Box software requires certain minimum system specifications as shown on the freedombox.info website. Internet service provider charges may apply to users connecting to the Freedom Box network outside the United States or Canada.
The Freedom Box.
It's freedom in a box.
For the latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organizations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.
Programming on ACB Radio is made possible in part through financial support from the Verizon Corporation. Verizon, a proud supporter of ACB Radio.
O'clock Universal Time, that's Blind Line Time. Hi, I'm Jonathan Mosen. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Blind Line is the original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. Let's look at what's on the program today. Well, we'll start with a chat with Marianne Diamond, who is in charge of Blind Citizens Australia, or at least the executive director of BCA, and we'll find out all about that and some of the issues that are occupying the attention of blind people over in Australia, and we may even talk about a few international matters as well. After that, it's the open forum part of the program, and something a bit different today due to public requests. We will be seeking comment from people who haven't phoned the program in the last month or so. Hopefully that will give us a few new voices. If you've never called the show before, well, you're particularly welcome. That's coming up a bit later, and there'll be a number of issues that I'll put forward and some that you may want to discuss as well, all coming up over the next 2 hours. But now, time to talk about Blind Citizens Australia, an organisation that's extremely active in Australia, advocating for the needs of blind and visually impaired people, and also it's active internationally as well, and we'll focus on all of those aspects of the work of BCA with Marianne Diamond. And Marianne, it's great to have you on. We've been meaning to chat to you for a long time, so welcome to Blindline.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You just come back from WBU's executive meeting, and I guess I should ask you how that went.
Yes, it was held in Mumbai, and it was very interesting. I'd never been to India before, so that was educational in itself, but the meetings went well. We meet very irregular, so it is very useful to catch up, and some quite significant things were discussed, and plans for the future put in place.
That's good to hear, and we'll come back and talk about World Blind Union a bit later. But Blind Citizens Australia, can you give us a bit of an overview of the history of BCA, when it was founded and how it was founded?
Yeah, Blind Citizens Australia was founded in 1975 out of a growing need, I guess, of the need for blind people to lobby and speak on behalf of themselves. Traditionally in this country, the service providers had always done that for us, and blind people weren't as leaders of those organisations. So a number of people got together in the lounge room of someone's house, I believe, and started this organisation. And David Blyth was the first president of Blind Citizens Australia.
And he went on to have a distinguished career both in BCA and the World Blind Union, ultimately.
Right, yes, he's certainly well known worldwide. The organisation has grown in that time, from, you know, the employment of one staff member you know, in a secretarial role, I guess, to now quite a number of staff undertaking different aspects of our advocacy and policy work.
When you look at how far you've come in just a quarter of a century, it's quite remarkable. And I wonder why it took until 1975, given that in the US and New Zealand and other countries, consumer groups were formed quite a lot earlier than 1975.
Yeah, in Australia, certainly we've come a long way in the 25 years. We're now called upon by government and other bodies, you know, to speak or respond to things on behalf of blind people. And there's other such groups in the disability sector here. I'm not as confident in my knowledge of what happens in other countries as maybe others are who are listening, so I don't really want to say what happens elsewhere. But certainly here in this country, we are kind of well thought of by government and called upon often.
Was that difficult to achieve, that change of mindset that said, look, don't go to the providers, talk to people who are actually users of the service who have full first-hand experience?
Yeah, I think it happened over time. It doesn't just suddenly happen, and it happens because of particular individuals such as David Blyth, Bill Jolly, Michael Simpson, and other people who are all names people around the world would know, but who have worked hard with government, with the service providers, and with blind people. So it's the strength of it is that union, the coming together. And one thing that, since I've been in this job, I try to do, and that is say we work with the service providers, not in opposition to them. And I think that's kind of part of what's given BCA its strength.
Yes, there's not that history there of open conflict, although obviously occasionally you do have to take a particular service provider on, I guess, over a given issue.
That's right. You know, from time to time there has been and still is issues of conflict, but I guess I'd describe it as working collaboratively with them is managing that conflict and stress and, you know, being respectful of the other person's position so that we can work through an issue and come to a satisfactory end.
How is Blind Citizens Australia structured? How does it actually operate?
We have a board of directors, which there is about between six and eight directors at any one time, each elected for a three-year period. We also have a National Policy and Development Council, and that consists of all the board members, all the directors, plus an elected representative from each of our state or territory that has more than 50 full members of Blind Citizens Australia. So that's kind of like our governance is by the board and our policy direction and development is by the National Policy Council. We then have in each state a number of branches, that's regional and special interest branches, that members can participate in a social or whatever way that the branch determines they want to meet, whether it be socially or whether it be over issues, discussion on policy, whatever. And that varies, of course, from state to state and individual group to individual group. So that's kind of the structure of the organisation. We have a number of categories of membership too. Everybody who is what we define as legally blind, that is entitled to a disability support pension blind in Australia, has the right to join as a full member. Then we have associate membership is individuals who support the work of our organisation but are not eligible to be full members. We have junior members, that's legally blind people under the age of 18 years. Then we have two classes of organisational members. Class A are where an organisation who is managed by a board of directors or a committee of management with more than 50% of that board consisting of blind people. And organisational class B are organisations who may support the work we do but don't fit category class A. There's kind of a variety of membership categories there.
660, I think, is the cut-off point, is it not? For
legally blind?
Yeah.
That's right, 660, or a visual arc of less than 10 degrees.
So what does full membership entitle one to do that other members are not able to do?
Only full members can stand election for the board or National Policy Council. Move, second and vote at any branch or a convention where there's resolutions and so on. That's more the right. Everybody is entitled to copies of all our publications and such. I guess the main thing is we are run by blind people, so that the primary thing is that blind people have the ability to, you know, to run the organisation at the board level.
Yes, it's fascinating to see how this varies from country to country and even organisation to organisation. And do you often get this issue coming up from time to time, that people who perhaps could legitimately call themselves visually impaired but who don't qualify as legally blind don't have those voting rights in Blind Citizens Australia?
From time to time we do. In general, it's very clearly spelled out on the membership form and people are aware of it when they first join. But sometimes people forget, and over time, and if there's a branch kind of committee being set up, you know, they may wish to kind of, you know, vote, and they're not entitled to vote, you know, that kind of thing. And then we get a bit of an issue of, you know, that's reverse discrimination type stuff. But it's managed very well, and I think people do respect the view that blind people have the right to manage their own organisation.
Yeah, interesting. The special interest concept is a good one, because I find that in various consumer groups what often happens is that you get some very talented people who may not be interested in what I like to think of as the parish pump kind of stuff that goes on at a geographical branch level, but who are very able and have specific interests. Is that the idea behind the special interest branches, to attract those people?
Yeah, or it's really where a group of people say, well, we have a particular interest and we need to get together to forward that and make sure it forms part of BCA policy and, you know, input into the organisation future development. But, yeah, there are people, for example, who are interested in, say, computers and computer technology, but have not really much interest in anything else we do other than just be, you know, behind the scenes. So I guess they fit into that category. We've got, in special interest at the moment, women's branch, of course, a national women's branch, and also youth. One of the areas that we are trying to develop here and working hard to develop is the youth, you know, finding our successes, so to speak. Mm. And both here in the state of Victoria and now in Queensland, we have established a youth branch. And because it's not a regional branch, we call it a special interest branch.
Right. Okay.
And we have an overseas aid branch too, where a group of people who have, you know, at their own initiative determined that they want to support people in developing countries. So they package and send braille paper and, you know, whatever they can to help with some of the countries in our region.
When I was attending the convention last year of Blind Citizens Australia, I was really impressed with the vigour and the vision, and perhaps with a bit of wistfulness at the idealism of young blind citizens who just seem to be so energetic and doing a lot. And succession is a big issue. It's hard to get people to join things these days, isn't it?
That's right. It's been a problem here in Australia for a long time. One being identifying and finding young people, because with our education system now being pretty well integrated from the outset, we don't seem to come across the you know, students as often as what we would have when we had a segregated education system. And secondly, you know, young people are busy people, you know, and they don't necessarily want to join up something like this. They don't, you know, at that stage. The only thing in Australia that's tended to continue to capture young people has been blind cricket. Blind cricket seems to have, all through the times, attracted young people, which I think is a good thing. But they haven't necessarily come over to BCA. But with our youth branch, we're finding that we started with a fairly social kind of approach, you know, come get to know each other. And you're right, they are enthusiastic, they are keen, they've got lots of good ideas. And that, you know, we have to find them, otherwise we'll all be gone and there'll be no one to take our place.
Yeah. And I think there's also an aspect of mentality in some younger people who want to be a bit separate from the blind community for a while, find their own identity, don't feel that they can survive in the mainstream community without having to resort to blind contacts.
I think that's true, and I have to say, Jonathan, that I probably fit that category myself. When I was a student at university, I had very little to do with the blindness sector, and I was a member of BCA, but not an active member, because, you know, I was okay. I was out having another life and managed quite well myself. But I think we all come to realise or want to be part of it at different stages of our lives. And one thing I said, I would say to our youth branch, and I think it's quite appropriate, is, you know, Blind Citizens Australia means different things to different people at different stages of their lives.
Yes. It's funny, isn't it, to when I went along to the seminar that I think BCA, Young Blind Citizens, put on, I think it was to do with fundraising, or the way that blindness was portrayed in the media, that's what
media,
it was.
Yes.
Very interesting discussion there. And it just really hit home that the issues that you feel strongly about do change over time, you know? And you're right, yeah, the organisation has to be strong enough, whatever the organisation is, to evolve with those needs.
That's right, and to kind of respect and represent the needs of those varying groups.
Mm. Well, so how did you get mixed up in Blind Citizens Australia? You mentioned that you were a member at university, but not really actively involved
That's
at that
right,
time.
That's right, Jonathan. I joined when Blind Citizens Australia was in its early days. You know, I did join up and, you know, got the correspondence, but didn't really attend very many things. But I have four children, one of which is blind, and when he was born in the late 80s, I took quite an active interest of what services were around for parents and for children, blind children, in this state. And I suppose I discovered firsthand that, you know, things aren't all that simple and, you know, that, you know, for a lot of people it was very difficult to even find out what it was available besides tap into it. So I found myself getting quite active in that area and progressively got myself more involved in Blind Citizens Australia, where I kind of took on a bit of the issues of education. You know, like I became a person who knew what entitlements were around in education, what resources were available. And after I lived in the States in 95, I came back and there was a position of advocacy information in Victoria going, so I applied for it and I had a career change.
That's
incredible.
How we
got here.
It's funny how those things fall into place, though.
That's right, yeah.
Funny
yeah,
part.
Well, I'd worked in information technology for a long, long time, and when I went and lived overseas, I'd taken leave from my job, and, you know, it was a good job, but this was something that I found myself doing a lot of, and I quite enjoyed.
It seems to me that one of the most under-advocated for group of blind people would have to be blind parents, but blind mothers in particular, because they're so busy just doing that valuable job of bringing up the next generation, that often it isn't easy for them to get out to meetings and bring the issues to the table that are of concern to them.
I think that's true. I think for parents it's particularly hard, especially when you can't go to meetings for lots of reasons, like you just outlined. But also, if you're not there, you don't know what other people are saying and thinking and doing. One of the things I've discovered is that parents seem to have fairly low expectations of their blind children, which is because they don't have access to role models often.
Yes.
I think that is a real problem, and that they often don't complain when they should complain, and therefore get trampled a bit. You know, and that goes right through into the education system.
Mainstreaming is compounding that problem too, isn't it? Because there are fewer blind people, I guess, in the one place, and therefore there's not that kind of self-perpetuating momentum that goes on where people are challenging one another, and you get this mentality, oh, well, he's doing all right, considering.
Yes, and I've discovered this even with my son, who's blind, and although I'm blind, he's very lucky compared to most. There is kind of this overlying attitude in the school, well, under the circumstances, he's doing well, whereas, you know, what's that mean? Yeah, the schools then tend to do that too, I think.
Yes. Does Blind Citizens Australia play any kind of role in that area, trying to be provide blind adult mentors to parents?
Well, we do, and we have a problem here is finding the parents. Like I said about the mainstreaming, we don't know them. People come to us where we tend not to mentor, although that's something we could take up. We tend to provide advocacy services to parents when required, especially in the areas of education and early intervention programs. One of the problems is that often I'll talk to them and offer a lot of help, or other staff here will, and it's like they're very hesitant to do anything in case their child is treated less favourably. You know, that kind of whole stuff becomes a real problem.
Yes. Absolutely.
But certainly when we have our conventions or forums for different topics, we try and encourage the list of parents that we got to come along. Even if their children are very young and it's not relevant to them now, just as a means of, you know, what's available, what's around the corner, and the role modelling type issues.
What sort of experience have you had with the phenomenon of the super blind, that quite often you get so-called professionals in the blindness field saying, well, you know, you can't expect to compare yourself with Marianne Diamond because people like her are super blind, and that's not a realistic achievement to expect your son or daughter to achieve.
Well, there is some of that here. I guess the line I always take, well, your child can achieve whatever they set out to achieve pretty well, you know. I am also conscious of the fact that some of us who are more known or in the public arena of blind people in Australia are the ones who have, for lots of reasons, been more successful than others. And success can mean in a lot of things. I might have just had better access to education, you know, might be just lucky to be born a more outgoing person. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff. Had families that encourage us to get out. But I guess my view is, and I say to parents, you know, well, yeah, let your child be what they want to be. And don't use me as a guide.
Yes, yes, fair enough. So the attracting of new members is always a big issue, and it sounds like you have a number of strategies in place. One of them is outreach, and of course you do a publication called Blind Citizens News, which has a lot of fascinating material in there. Is that quarterly that comes out?
Yeah, that's our national quarterly newsletter, and we put that out in large print braille audio cassette via email, and we also place it on our website for people to read.
Yes, it's a good website overall, and certainly that is really worth reading. I try and make sure to take a look at that every quarter and find out what's there. And that obviously achieves some results for you in terms of not just informing your existing membership, the faithful, as it were, what's going on, but also telling others, you know, this is why you should be involved with BCA. It's achieving results.
Yeah, that's true. And also to people who may never be members but may, you know, be interested and in the work we do, and it may affect other work. Like, we send it off to a lot of our funding bodies and government people, and others who might one day, it might be relevant for them to join or appropriate for them to join, or maybe they'd like to contribute to us, whatever suits the occasion. But we try and distribute it quite widely in the community.
I'm sure if I'm misstating this model, you'll let me know, but it seems to me that you've taken a very good approach here, which is that you've said to government bodies and people who need information about blindness in a policy setting context, look, we are actually the experts, and our expertise is worth money, and you should be paying us for our expert opinion on how to deal with this public policy matter. So you actually market yourselves, it seems, as consultants who are expert in blindness and have something worth purchasing.
That's right, and we do it kind of in that context, but we also do it by tendering in the, you know, tendering process for projects.
Right.
So that the government may say, well, we're going to fund some projects in this area, and people can put in expressions of interest, and we will do so. So we go in a competitive tendering, and sometimes we are successful and sometimes we're not. But you're right, I guess we're saying that in the areas of policy, whatever that means, we as blind people are the ones you should consult with.
And that seems to have worked for you.
Yes, it has. I mean, there's always issues where, you know, there's always more to do than we have the time, resources and people to do. But we've gone a long way down the track, I think, than a lot of other disability groups in this country.
What are your relations like with those other disability groups? Because there are, I guess, degrees of willingness to cooperate within the blind community generally. Some people believe that the whole generic disability approach is a huge mistake and is doing us harm, and others want to get right in there, and many are in the middle there. Where does BCA sit in terms of its involvement with cross-disability organisations?
Well, at the moment in Australia, there's the federal government has provided funds to set up a federation of disability organisations in this country. That's the coming together of the consumer bodies of all the disability groups. Now, there's kind of whether that's good or bad is one issue, but basically, unless we agree to be part of it, we don't get any funding for our organisation, so we have no choice. And I mean, the view that we've taken and other of the disability groups have been, well, there's lots of issues where we can work together on, so long as we respect and the government recognises that there are other issues where we need to speak on behalf of our own sector. So at the moment, we seem to be working quite well, some more than others, and often that's the personalities. Even though the issues with some disability groups are easier to deal with than others, I personally, in the year I've been here, have found that I've worked better with the ones who have a more cooperative, you know, just general person who is willing to kind of work through issues rather than just oppose them. So, I mean, it's forced upon us. We're trying to work with them, but we also recognise that at times we can't agree with them. And an example of that is the Physical Disability Council of Australia, who I actually think I work quite well with, released a model for the disability support payment system, a proposal for how it should go in Australia, of which we could not agree to because it would not be as good as what we have now. Blind people in this country, of course, have a lot more benefits under the disability support pension scheme than other disabilities. So our view is that we would want everyone to come up to our level, not go back to a common denominator.
That must be a real source of tension, because it's much easier to dwell on the negative.
That's right. It is a bit of a source of contention, but the way we're doing it is we're undertaking our own research study in Blind Citizens Australia into the non-optional costs of blindness. And we're doing this through a few mechanisms, like we held some forums, we're doing some in-depth surveying, we're going to have some diary keeping of people to try and get some quantitative and, you know, qualitative data of what kind of non-optional costs people have due to their blindness. Because the one the physical disability did, they actually started off saying it was for physical disability only, and then they extended the study and said it was for all disabilities, whereas our objection is, well, we should have been included in the beginning, but we weren't.
Yeah, and that's one of the dangers of this whole generic thing.
Yes. So that's an example where we, you know, although we work quite well with them, we've actually stood quite separate, you know. And the other one, of course, in this country is tactile ground surface indicators, TGSIs, using them for our orientation and mobility, especially around rail train stations and bus stops. And, of course, Physical Disability Council have different views on that because of wheelchair and you know, mobility aids for their members. So that's kind of another issue of contention. But the way I think we're looking at going around it is trying to jointly get some funding from government to jointly undertake a study.
Okay. So BCA's position on the benefit issue, the pension issue, is that there are certain costs of blindness that the state has an obligation to compensate for. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. That's our view. Is
right.
But at the moment, what we're trying to do is do this study to find out just what that kind of level of cost is.
Now, in Australia, I understand there are also quite a few concessions, such as half price, well, telephone rental and different things. I don't know if they still exist as widely as they used to. But do you have a general view on whether, if that argument about costs of blindness is going to wash, whether in fact blind people would have to forego some of those other concessions and accept that this one payment, whatever that's calculated to be, is the sum total of payment for the costs of blindness?
There is a view that may be the case, and that certainly the view of the Commonwealth government, who pay all these benefits, want to have a single payment system where, yeah, everyone gets the same, you know. That would suit their model. Yes, I think that is an issue, although our benefits, such as you mentioned telephone and other things, are not quite as generous as they once were. They may have once been 50%, but what's happened often is they stayed at that rate and the things went up, so they're down like about 25% or something now. But also we're looking at things like access to employment training programs and, you know, workplace modification programs where equipment and things for your workplace can be purchased in advance of you starting work. So there's a whole lot of areas that such concessions haven't covered really anyway.
Right. What about, for example, when a blind person gets on a bus, or in the case of Melbourne, gets on a tram, and they're on free because they've got a pass? Is that going to be appropriate if you continue with the costs of blindness argument?
It's difficult to know because, see, some things are administered through the Commonwealth Government and some through state.
Mm.
Transport is through a state government at the moment. That could be a problem. We wouldn't see it as part of this necessarily because we're actually gearing our cost of blindness at the federal government, the ones who pay the benefits. But you're right, that could become a problem. And what you're entitled to in our country varies from state to state, and that's kind of a big confusion in itself. Your transport entitlements in Victoria are not the same as those in New South Wales or Queensland. Although we have worked hard and almost have on the board a national blind travel pass, which means that I could take my travel pass to Queensland, Western Australia or whatever and use it to the entitlements they have. We're just waiting for New South Wales to sign on for that. And we also have an agreement with the taxi programs that we can have vouchers and use interstate vouchers for our discounted taxis. So a lot of them are state-based. They could become an issue, but we're kind of holding back at this stage and waiting to see what this data tells us.
We may
choose not to use it, of course.
Right, yes, okay. When do you expect to have that data collection process complete in the...
September.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a possibility that if a magic number is come up with, that it might be less than what you're getting now?
I don't think it'll probably be less. And I'm not sure that a magic number in itself will come up. We may come up with different options because people's needs are different in different stages of their lives.
Right.
Like, for example, our current position before we undertook this study was that people who are blind should be entitled to receive the Disability Support Pension Blind, as they get now, but also be entitled to access other government services such as employment training programs and so on. Whereas at the moment, if we get a Disability Support Blind pension, we are not entitled to a lot of other benefits.
Okay. One of the things that's difficult about this kind of exercise is that you've got to get the timing right, and obviously you have in this case, because often we're all tempted to just let things ride until there's some sort of threat or challenge to them. And then it seems to me that what's happened in Australia, on my reading of it, is that whenever the blind pension is under some kind of challenge, that challenge has been defeated with brute force, if you like, that no one's really interested at the time in that kind of cost of blindness argument, that the idea of white canes and guide dogs at Parliament in Canberra is so scary that the public servants just quietly back down and you've never had the argument.
That's true, and I think historically that's always been the case, that, you know, we mount a campaign and we seem to do quite well, our numbers are quite small. However, in the last couple of years, the government did undertake a research into the whole welfare system, and as they've their model they wish to move towards is a single payment system. So I don't think they're out to take away the blind pension. However, I think as they move to the single payment system, the blind pension could be lost purely by that mechanism. So it's kind of a different approach from the government this time.
Yeah.
So we've decided to not just talk about it, but to try and, you know, progress it a bit, you know, the way we want to go.
It's good stuff. And, of course, it's an anomaly. And no doubt, as governments get a bit more hard-nosed about these sorts of issues, it's inevitably going to keep coming up. Well, why do we pay such a different kind of pension to blind people as compared with other people with disabilities?
Oh, that's right. And it's often been, you know, said to me by different parliamentarians. You know, they can all say that they know some rich blind person who's getting a pension and how unfair that is. I mean, you know, you can always find an argument. But blind people in this country worked very hard, you know, in times gone by to get themselves into this situation. And I guess we're not ready to let it go.
Yes. And the problem is that most modern governments these days have a view that welfare and work are mutually exclusive, that the concept of a universal welfare system is not very popular these days.
That's right, but then that's kind of where our country's heading at the moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll wait and see.
Just looking at a bit of the history of this, because this pension dates long, long back before BCA came along, how did that advocacy actually work when there was no national organisation of the blind? There must have been some pretty determined blind people who got
that. I think my understanding from individuals that there was, and a lot of it came about after the Second World War, and there was a lot of returned veterans who were blind, and they must have been fairly good lobbyists.
Yeah.
And this is where the the benefits kind of came from, and then just individuals who were very strong must have all come together from time to time to ensure that it was, you know, remained. And then certainly since Blind Citizens Australia was established, it's certainly been an issue that's come and gone a lot. You know, every time the budget comes down from the government each year, it's always a wonder if we'll, you know, if this will be tagged again this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what it's like.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you were also looking at, I don't know whether this is on the back burner now, but it interested me a few years ago, was the material on digital audio broadcasting that Blind Citizens Australia was working on, because increasingly we're moving to all sorts of appliances, whether they be radios or stereos or washing machines or microwaves, that are difficult to use. And BCA made an effort to get it on the ground floor and try and ensure that from the beginning digital audio broadcasting was accessible, because the radio is such an important medium for blind people. Did DAB ever get off the ground in Australia? What's the story?
Well, we got some funding and undertook a study onto with television, digital, you know,
Audio description.
And John Simpson led that work. That project's, you know, been done. We've distributed it, but it's due to funding that we're actually not proceeding with it right now, but it is on our policy list of things to, you know, obtain funding to continue with, because certainly in Australia the deafness community have been very successful in getting captioning on certain hours of television on a trial basis in some states. So between, like, on peak time, that all programs are captioned.
Yes.
And I guess that our view is that we need to be moving kind of with them, if not, you know, like, slightly differently, but, you know, along the same lines. So it's kind of on the back burner, but not gone away, I guess.
And in terms of digital radio, did the ABC or somebody ever started really broadcasting in the new digital radio system that BCA was also working on?
Yeah, that's kind of also a bit in the same category. John Simpson, you know, did some of that work, and, you know, he's moved on now, and we're kind of there, but more on the outskirts rather than right in there.
Okay. What else are the what else is occupying the attention of Blind Citizens Australia at the moment? Other matters that you're working on?
One area that's quite busy for us is the Building Code of Australia standards. Under the Disability Discrimination Act that came in 1992, provision was made to develop standards to which people must comply in all different areas to meet that DDA. One of them is the Building Codes of Australia need to update their own code, taking into account the needs of people with disabilities. So we're busy working on access to premises standard, and that covers things like signage, you know, braille and tactile signage, indicators when you walk into a building, you know, lifts, floor coverings, TGSIs, lifts, announcements, or signage. A lot of that kind of stuff is taking up a lot of time because, once again, you're dealing with Standards Australia, the Building Code Board, all the other disability sector groups. So so we're kind of doing a lot of input onto that. Because, of course, as you could imagine, the builders, they don't really want to pay too much for any of this stuff.
No. And the whole DDA issue fascinates me, because I was talking about this with somebody last week from the US who was commenting very favourably on the fact that your disability legislation is much less complaints driven, although mechanisms exist for complaints, but that it's all about standards and consultation, and that those standards are legally enforceable. Is that a model that you think is working?
I think in Australia the complaints works, because although better than the standards, we have people developing the standards, but as yet the transport one's the only one that's got as far as the federal government. I mean, there's a lot of things that stop the others even going too far.
What is it that holds them up?
A whole lot of different issues between the disability groups, the service, the providers, not service providers for disability, but can be the, say, the train companies or the bus companies or that kind of stuff. We in Blind Citizens Australia would use the complaint system mostly. There are problems with that too, and some of that is timing cost and that. But I think ideally I would agree with that person you spoke to that the standards should be what's used, and you know it's legislative so that people have to comply. We've just found the standards of 10 years have gone by and we don't have too many standards kind of in place. I mean, a lot of drafts and a lot of discussion, but not too many are there.
Is that really because the disability community is being outlawed by big business?
Yeah, it could be seen as that. In some cases, I think there's differences between the disability groups too. Education is a good example of that. We all have very different views of what education standards should cover, and it's very difficult because if something isn't in the standard, then that will become a problem if it's, you know, later determined that it should have been, you know.
Uh-huh. So
say educators will want very minimal in the standard because they don't want to have to, you know, comply if they don't have to. We want everything in the standard, of course.
What do you want in terms of blindness? Because in the mainstream, one of the big barriers, it seems to me, is that obviously the teachers are not literate in the form of literacy that blind people need. And can blind people ever really get equitable access to literacy skills in the mainstream, I wonder?
Well, I think that's a point, but I guess it's how you go about it. I think the position I would take is that blind people have the right to be educated in the skills of blindness skills like Braille and literacy and that by a trained, qualified teacher of blindness. You're right that they don't sit in every school, but then we have different mechanisms here where you have itinerant teachers, you may have a special education blindness unit in some schools. We have sometimes where the students go to Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind for a reverse or for a day or a day a month or in some cases more often, where they can have particular training in certain areas. It's not ideal, but I guess it's the combination of a whole lot of things. Certainly, the training of teachers is a big problem in this country.
And yet for other disability groups, it's a lot more black and white, isn't it? As far as they're concerned, every child has the right to attend their local school, and that's the bottom line, that's the beginning and end of it.
Yes, yes. We can see it a lot clearer in their position, you know, like especially physical or even hearings with the aids, whereas, In blindness, your integration age, that's not your teachers, but the supporters of children who are blind don't have to be trained in any blindness skills, whereas to be an interpreter for a deaf student, they do. They're called interpreters, not teacher's aides. That's kind of a really big distinction, too, between your support there.
Difficult. What other standards are being worked on at the moment? You've mentioned education and obviously the building code issue is being worked through.
The transport one's gone through.
Right.
One started on access to information, although that's kind of not going far at the moment.
And yet that's really critical for blind people, isn't it?
Yes.
What do you want that to say?
Well, one of the things that we've worked for, in we're starting with all Commonwealth and state, all government bodies for a start, that they have all their materials, sites, etc. Being accessible. Now, we haven't even got that here. You know, we have ongoing issues where forms and documents and letters are sent out from Centrelink, which is the department that provide all our disability pensions and family payments and that, still going out to people in a form that they cannot read. You know, so we're starting with, you know, all of the people who, you know, govern our lives and our countries to start with making everything accessible.
Now, I'm interested in this because Bruce Maguire took a world-changing complaint under the DDA that said that he couldn't get his Olympic Games ticket program in Braille and won. So can't you use the DDA to put pressure on the government over that?
Well, we've actually taken a different approach. We've actually got ourselves just recently a position on what we call the Centrelink reference group, which means that we're sitting at the table now with the policy people. So that's made a difference, and we have lodged some complaints just recently under the DDA about the materials being sent out not being in Braille. So that it all takes time. Like,
yeah.
Bruce's case is kind of something that we refer to regularly when we lodge complaints.
So really, it's a question of when to use the carrot and when to use the stick, and that's a judgment call.
That's right, and sometimes we use a combination of. Certainly, an example of that is with the accessible ATM machines for banking, we took a decision about a year and a half ago now that we would work with the Australian Bankers Association as they develop their own action plan and time frame for making things accessible. But at the same time, we would lodge complaints against the major banks. And our belief being, and I think this is true, and it proved to be true, that it made the Australian Bankers Association move more quickly when there were some complaints lodged.
We had Lainey Feingold on the program last week talking about accessible ATMs. How are you getting on with that? Have the first arrived in Australia?
Well, we have a couple here now on live trials. You know, there's one just not far from where I work with the National Australia Bank, and that's a trial. And they've got timetables, a couple of the major banks now, for their rollout of their stock, and they've provided it to us. Other banks haven't been as cooperative. However, our view is if we get a couple of the major banks rolling them out, you know, and advertising it, it will follow through to the rest.
What are the objections that you were getting from the banking industry about rolling these out, and how have you countered those objections?
Mainly it'll be cost, and another was, you know, security. I think a lot of it is ignorance too, that, you know, when they've seen one that's demonstrated and it works very effectively, that they're more interested. But certainly cost becomes a factor. But then, you know, it's equal access, you know, the DDA is quite strong and clear on that.
How do you respond to this? Because this is something that I've heard from a lot of banking types, that the security issue is a big one, and that somehow blind people are going to be in danger if they have a talking ATM machine.
Yeah, well, the one that is just located not far from here, you use earphones, so really other people don't know what you're doing or saying, as you're doing your transactions. I guess it's an education thing. Like, we found that with the bank, we needed to do a bit of education about the abilities of blind people so that they could be convinced that we could manage them. So I guess we've kind of dealt with it bank by bank, but with our four major banks, we've been fairly successful, I think.
Excellent. That's good to hear. And so they are coming.
That's right, yes.
Is the policy going to be that whenever an ATM is replaced, it will be replaced with an accessible one?
And that's how the rollouts are occurring.
Yeah.
I mean, and I do take on board, and it's a fair comment, that they're not just going to go and rip out every ATM machine in every wall, but they do replace them, you know, from time to time anyway, so that as they replace them, new ones will be accessible.
I'd like to talk a bit about BCA's international commitments, because it's always been a significant player on the world stage since its foundation, and of course it was the host for the World Blind Union, or Melbourne was the host of it, in 2000. What is it about being involved in the international scene that motivates BCA to be as involved as it is?
Well, I think involvement in the international scene has been... the interest came from initially, anyway, the interest and desire to work internationally of individuals. You know, people were very keen to know what was happening in the rest of the world. They had been involved in organisations of and for the blind prior to the establishment of World Blind Union. And there is a sense of satisfaction and, you know, interest and all that that goes with, you know, knowing how what happens in other countries, what people do, and how we can, a country with more resources than others, support them. I think the holding of the 5th General Assembly here in Melbourne was tremendous for Australia, because for many people who hadn't been in the past involved in the World Blind Union, and I was one of them, it was for the first time brought to our home, you know, and the ongoing interest now amongst our members is, of course, you know, far greater than before. And I think we do have things to offer. We've done projects into other countries in the past. You know, we have some access from time to time to resources for, you know, outside aid from our country. And, you know, I think if we all could do that, it's terrific. And we can learn from the other countries too. You know, we've got a lot to learn in Australia as well.
Yes, the image of World Blind Union with rank and file blind people in Western countries is something that probably needs to be given a bit of scrutiny, because not many blind people actually seem to know what it does. They know that the World Blind Union exists, but it's almost like it's this mysterious clique out there somewhere, and they really just don't know what it's up to.
Oh, I think that's true. And like I say, I think I would have been one of them. in the past. And I think, you know, every 4 years meeting is fairly infrequently, so that people probably do wonder what happens between those 4 years.
What can be done about that, do you think?
Well, I guess it's up to all of us who have some involvement to, you know, take on board to, you know, to, I guess, share information, talk to people, you know. And one of the things we've done at the last meeting, at the executive meeting, was kind of request that a lot of the papers, position papers, documents and that be put on a web page, that, you know, and be distributed to anyone who wants it, not just to the elected officers or whatever. You know, so the World Blind Union are writing a lot of papers. We say a lot of things, but we don't go telling everyone this is the position or this is what we're doing. And I think you have a fair point there.
Okay. So I've heard for some time that there's going to be a quite rejuvenated World Blind Union website, and it sounds like from what you're saying that that's well and truly on track.
Hopefully. That's right. I believe that it's pretty well ready to be launched, but I haven't seen it myself.
Mm.
Certainly... In my role as chair of the Women's Committee, I was getting a bit tired of waiting, so we developed our own webpage.
Okay.
And the idea being that when the revamped WBU webpage is up and running, we'll link it back onto there. But I thought, well, this is at least a way people can come across the World Blind Union, know what you're doing, you know what the issues are. So other committees, I think, were doing a similar thing.
There has been fantastic growth in the last decade or so in terms of participation by women in WBU, and it's very pleasing to see.
That's right, and a lot of that was driven by David Blyth as his presidency. One of his stance when he stood for president was to actually increase the participation of women in the World Blind Union, and he often refers to in 92 when he was elected, I think he says there was about 13 women delegates, and in 96 when he finished his term there was about a third women delegate. So, you know, things have certainly changed. But I think, you know, there's still a fair bit to go. Just one of the comments I make, just having numbers doesn't necessarily mean equal participation either.
No, that's right. And how do you deal with those cultural issues? Because the World Blind Union is such a diverse body of people that For some people, perhaps participation of women at that level may not even be culturally appropriate.
That's right, and I think we have to be quite respectful of that and mindful of it, and try and work a way that people work around and find ways that people can participate, even if it's in a different way than what we, in our minds, would think is a participation level. You know, like for some people to stand up at a meeting and speak is something they could never do. So I guess we need to devise mechanisms that they can have their input through another means. One of the things I've undertaken to do just at the last week was, you know, to establish for World Blind Union a women's email discussion list. People seem really keen on that, that maybe they'd be more free and comfortable to express their opinions about a lot of things on a kind of closed list.
Yes.
So, I mean, we can only try it and see how it works. And another thing, certainly in the Women's Committee, that each person undertook to do was to identify and mentor someone in their own region about the World Blind Union and the Women's Committee and their work, looking towards, our succession planning and the future.
That raises a question about the tension that it appears to me to exist between the use of technology and the risk of shutting people out who don't have access to that technology. And I remember, I think it was on the last day of the General Assembly, somebody got up and very passionately pointed out that it's all very well to talk about technology and access to information when we have people in the room who can't even get a white cane. How does one deal with that tension in an organisation like the World Blind Union?
Well, I think... there's probably no real answer, but when I say about the web page, the email discussion list, we're always mindful that that doesn't cover all women of the world. I am quite aware of that. However, I guess we need to have a number of strategies running simultaneously to try and touch as many people as possible. Some suggestions we've looked at have been that, you know, even if someone who does have email contact can be put in contact with someone who doesn't, and whether they use a telephone or a fax or, you know, like even whatever method is appropriate to that group to kind of communicate with them. or whether we look at, one option was to look at, you know, to buy some technology, you know, for people. I don't know if there's a real answer, but I guess we have to try all things at our disposal to try and communicate. Certainly in our own region here in East Asia Pacific, communicating with people in some of the countries is extremely difficult. Papua New Guinea, Samoa, some of them, you know, it's not just the African countries, for example, it's right here at our doorstep.
Do you think the World Blind Union itself can really make a practical policy difference, or is its primary role to bring people together and motivate them to go back and make a difference at their own country level, having found out what's possible?
Maybe it's a bit of both. I think certainly the second one, to support and help people going back into their own countries to make a difference is one. I guess when we're looking at the first one you suggest, and that is making a difference, maybe it makes a difference on a universal level, you know, through things like United Nations and such bodies. That's the, you know, how the overall organisation makes a big difference. But I think it's the support and the resourcing and skill development of people to go back into their own communities, I think, which is the most powerful kind of approach. I mean, we can sit up here and say, you know, you should do this, this and this, but we all know the reality of it is we all go home, we're all busy people. And to take what someone does in Australia into a country of Africa is quite different.
It's good to note that Euclid Hery had quite an impact at the Universal Postal Union level, for example, on the continuation of the International Articles for the Blind scheme.
That's right, and that's kind of things where the World Blind Union as the overall arching body can be quite powerful, I would imagine.
So what's
and, I mean, international copyright would have to be one would be good to see the World Blind Union take up and push on too.
Oh, man, yes. Yes. You must get a lot of feedback, as we do here, about the frustration that occurs when there's all this information out on the web now from websites
right.
like Bookshare and WebBraille that people outside of the US can't use.
Yeah, it's certainly a big problem here, and I guess it's one of the things that we're trying to push in Australia to get our National Library, you know, just the Australian National Library, to kind of push on to. And it was raised at the executive meeting in World Blind Union about this whole copyright issue. But I think that's kind of a really big one that could, you know, open up, as you say, a world of materials to all of us.
Yes, it's special format material is so scarce that it's a shame that we have to be a bit precious about country borders, whether that's because of the law or otherwise. The Unified Braille Code is another area where you've Blind Citizens Australia have been involved, where this is another example, because Braille that is written in a particular type of maths code, for example, can't be used in a developing country where that maths code isn't being taught.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, once again, it's this same, you know, limited user base, and we just can't afford to be, you know, different codes among ourselves.
So what's in the future for Blind Citizens Australia? Where do you think it will be in, say, 5 years' time?
Well, that's a tricky question. I guess I can still see us in 5 years' time still addressing issues of individual advocacy, you know, where people are still encountering discrimination in employment, education, access to services. I'd be surprised if our whole DDA and the complaint system will go that far, that that'll all be gone. I'd like to see us also... whether it be promoting or encouraging or supporting blind people to actually hold senior positions in the blindness agencies. I guess until we start managing the service providing agencies, we're always going to be the advocacy group on the side. Now, whether we can achieve it, I'm not sure.
Interesting challenges.
And certainly another objective we have, say, down the track of 5 years, is to have a staff office in each of the Australian states. At the moment we have a national office here in Melbourne, we have some funding and a staff member for Victoria. We're on a trial basis, a very part-time one in New South Wales, just to see if we can get a service up and going, or some funding to kind of keep it up and going. But a lot of matters are state-based, and it would be, you know, very, very great advantage to blind people if we could have a staffed office in each state. So that's certainly one of our kind of 5 to 10-year goals.
Well, when you look at what you've achieved in the last 27 years it is now, who knows where you'll be after 30-odd years, because it really has been a remarkably busy, short history.
That it certainly has. You know, a very diverse, and like many groups such as ours, covering a lot of different issues at any one time.
Well, well done, and it's a pleasure to speak with you. I hope that we'll speak again as issues develop, and I really appreciate you giving up an hour to be on the show with us.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it.
Thanks. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Marianne Diamond, the Executive Director of Blind Citizens Australia, speaking to us from the BCA office in Melbourne. You're listening to Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream. We are opening up the Spider Phone. If you'd like to give us a call, area code 212-812-2800 is the number, area code 212-812-2800. And when you're asked to enter a conference code, it's 0480-5512. Thanks to Spider Phone for that, 0480-5512. And today, we're looking for people who haven't called Blindline in the last month. Get a few new or not so familiar voices on the air. So if you've never called the show before, especially, well, go on, pluck up the courage, pick up the phone, give us a call. We'll do our best to get you quickly. And if you're a less frequent caller, you're welcome as well. We'll come back and see if we can throw a few irons in the fire shortly. But if you'd like to give us a call now, by all means do so. We'll get you straight on the air.
When they're not broadcasting, the ACBRI DJs are hard at work creating personal web pages about their shows, the music they play, and even a little bit about themselves. And you can visit these web pages by going to the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring. To check out the web ring, go to interactive.acbradio.org. Then choose the link for the web ring. You can view a site at random, or you can look at a list of all the websites in the ring. So if you want to learn more about the personalities behind the microphone, go to interactive.acbradio.org and check out the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring.
ACB Radio Mainstream is always looking for new and innovative programming. But in 2002... they found me. I'm Dave Williams here in Preston, where we're putting together ACB Radio Mainstream's newest programme, The UK Connection. We start Thursdays at 1 GMT, that's Wednesday evenings in the States, with a mix of news, views and interviews. We're looking for your contributions as well, so drop us a line, dave@acbradio.org, that's dave@acbradio.org, or even pick up the phone and call the UK on 44700 533 8876. That's 44700 533 8876. The UK Connection.
Don't you think you sound tired?
Hang out with other ACB Radio listeners. Talk with the hosts. Provide suggestions about the future of ACB Radio. It's all possible through the ACB Radio Friends List.
Thank you for being a friend.
Log on and sign up now. Send a blank message to friends-subscribe@acbradio.org. That's friends-subscribe@acbradio.org. And thank you for being a friend of ACB Radio.
2 minutes past 2 UTC, let's go to this unknown caller. Hello there.
Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. It's raining here in Auckland.
Well, that's no good at all.
No, it's not. I just managed to switch on the interview that I managed, the portion of the interview that I managed to get, and they were talking about talking ATMs. Well, I've come across a few, not in Auckland, but a couple, one in Manukau City, one down in Tamanui.
Really?
Braille. Braille on it.
But do they talk?
No, they don't.
Oh, yeah, no, there are lots of them with Braille out there, but none in New Zealand, to my knowledge, that talk.
No, and who knows what is coming down in that particular area when it comes to talking ATMs. Have you come across it for yourself in your world travels?
Talking ATMs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Certainly in the States I've seen a few in action. They had one, I think it was last year, at the Iowa convention, at the National Convention of ACB, they had one from the Bank of America there that was up and running and talking.
Okay. What about over in Aussie? Have you come across any over there?
No, there are only a couple in Australia, and I haven't been anywhere where they are, but it looks like they're rolling them out there, so that's good news.
It's pretty cool. Well, heaps of Kiwis over there, so they'll probably give us feedback on what they're like, or perhaps when you go over there. Aren't you part of the worldwide Blind Union?
I'm sorry, what was that?
And you part of the World Blind Union?
Yes, I'm the treasurer of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific region.
Okay, then. Thanks, Jonathan.
Okay, have a good one.
Yep.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
And just a reminder to you that we're taking calls from people who haven't phoned Blindline in the last month today, so if you'd like to give us a call, area code 212-812-2800, that's area code 212-812-2800, and when you're asked to enter a conference code, courtesy of spiderphone.com, 0480-5512 is that number, 0480-5512, if you haven't called Blindline in the last month. Let's go to area code 651, hello there.
Hey, Jonathan.
Hi.
This is Joe. I think you might remember me. I called about, like, I don't know, like 3-4 months ago or something.
Yeah, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good, but how are you doing?
Good, good.
Yeah, that's good. I heard you talking about talking ATMs.
Yes.
I actually had one in, when I was putting money in and stuff, I finally got the C-mine. It had Braille on the keypad, and it talked. It had the eloquent speech. The only complaint I have was you can't speed up the speech.
Mm. This is the thing with some of these things. So it didn't have digitized human speech. It actually was running eloquence on yours.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Cool.
I mean, I don't know how, you know, I don't know if that's standard or not, but...
Well, you know. We had Lainey Feingold, yes, on the program last week, and that's in the archives, and she's a lawyer who's involved in accessible ATMs, and she was saying that generally... the past, you've had access through digitized speech, although to offer a wider range of services, there are now some that are offering synthesized speech, and obviously you've been using one of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I didn't know that they were offering digitized speech. I had no idea until you just told me.
Yeah, mostly humans just speaking the prompts,
yeah.
Recorded
uh-huh.
as wave files. So the eloquence was set quite slowly, was it?
Yeah, it was actually at the normal speed of what, like, JFW or Windows would do, and that's kind of annoying, I found it, because, you know, I'm obviously, well, yeah, I'm an experienced speech listener, and I kind of wish you could turn it up faster.
So, when you heard what you wanted to do with the machine, were you able to just go ahead and cut the speech off and execute your command?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's another thing, that's why I wish, you know, you could, turn the speech faster, because, you know, it's like you gotta, you know, your card comes out, and then if you don't take it in time, because you don't know, you know what I mean, and, you know, if you don't take it in time, then, you know, it could suck it back in, and you wouldn't have an ATM card.
Okay. And was it good, though? I mean, obviously, it gave you a kind of access, presumably, that you hadn't had before.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Would you have used an ATM before you had the machines talking? Like, could you go to one and memorize the prompts?
Actually, I didn't. I mean, I really had no idea what was what. So, I mean, you know, I went with my mom and stuff. She told me that what the thing was, and I was able to do it there. But that was, you know, I find that, you know, rather annoying. Because, you know, I guess they just installed the thing recently enough that I hadn't. Not been able to access it, but now that I can, it's good.
So here's an interesting thing. In New Zealand, we have a system called EFTPOS, which stands for Electronic Fund Transfer at Point of Sale. What a dreadful thing. But the way it works is that you go into, I don't know, pretty much any shop you can think of has this now. And you take your money card, your ATM card, and you type in your PIN, and it transfers the money from your bank account to the bank account of the shop. It's an instant money transfer, and quite often what you can do is you can get cash out at the same time. Like if you make a $5 purchase and you say credit, you know, $25, they'll give you $20 cash out of the till. Do you have anything like that in the States?
I don't know. I'm not sure if we do, but. Yeah, I'm not really sure, but that's neat. Kind of like, you know, that's like you can do your own like credit card purchases, kind of like.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, it's not even like a credit card. But when you use your regular money card, the money is actually at the very instant you type in your PIN, it's shifted, it's moved from your account to their account, and And it's really good because, as I say, just about every shop in the country has it now. And even when you get a pizza delivered, often now they have mobile machines with this. So you just give them your money card, type in your PIN, and the money's gone out of your account and into theirs. And it's a good way of getting cash, because if you just tell them, you know, credit a bit extra and give me the money back, then you don't need to go to an ATM. I just wondered if there's anything similar in the US.
I'm not sure. I'd actually like to know.
Yes, great system.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. Oh, well, I appreciate your call. Thanks for getting us going.
All right, actually, I have one more thing.
Well, good on you. Go for it.
Main menu edition 743, you reviewed the Samsung SEHM 105.
I did.
And you were talking about, great phone, by the way, you were talking about how you wish that there was a button you could press where the voice dial would tell you the number.
No, I said I wish there was.
Well, yeah. And
yeah.
Actually, I have a phone like it. You don't press a button, but if it's in the phone book as a voice dialing entry,
yeah.
If you have it set a certain way, you can have it do that.
Okay. So what phone is it that does that you have?
Sanyo SCP 4700.
Okay.
Put up by you from TCS.
What kind of network does that run on?
CDMA.
Okay. Great. Hey, that is interesting.
Yeah.
What other features does it have that make it good for blind people to use?
Well, it's a simple recording process of the voice dialing, and the menus don't wrap around. I don't know, you know, like there's not menu shortcuts, but they don't wrap around.
All right. Okay.
And,
gee. Well, that sounds like a really cool phone. I might have to try and investigate it next time I'm over in the States, because, that is just such a... It's so jolly well obvious, isn't it? I mean, if you've got voice entries in there and it's got caller ID, you'd think that all phones would do that.
I know. Totally. But they don't.
Well, great. I'll check that out. So that's the Sanyo. And what was the model number again?
SCP 4700.
Okay. That's great. Hey, well, thanks for bringing that to our attention, and hopefully people will investigate that, and you could record a review of it for Main Menu or something.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, good on you. Because, you know, it's not just about software, and a lot of people are really keen to find out information about appliances that talk and provide useful functionality like that.
Well, I might do that.
Good on you.
Main Menu. Cool.
Exactly.
Oh.
Fame at last.
Yeah.
Have a good evening.
You too.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
Yeah, we're really excited here in New Zealand because it's Oscar Day today. I think the Oscars have just started, and who knows, New Zealand may be scooping the Oscars as we speak. The Lord of the Rings, which was made here by a New Zealand director and filmed in Wellington, is up for about 13 Academy Award nominations, and also A Beautiful Mind stars New Zealander Russell Crowe. So, who knows? Big night for New Zealand, possibly, in the Oscars tonight. Let's go to this call. Hi, this is Blindline.
Hello, it's Nick.
Oh, Nick, I'm sorry, we're not talking to you today because we're taking people who haven't phoned in the last month. So, thanks for calling anyway. Blindline on ACB Radio Mainstream, and if you haven't called in the last month, give us a call, area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when you're asked for a conference code, it's 0480-5512. Let's go to area code 541. Hello there.
Well, hello, this is Stan. I know I haven't talked to you in the last month.
And it's a shame that you haven't. How nice to hear from you.
But you were asking about ATMs, about the point of sale.
Yeah.
Whether they were available in the United States. Yeah. Yes, they are.
How ubiquitous are they? Are they everywhere?
They're pretty good. In fact, some of the systems, in fact, I've got to tell you, the only bad thing is, in my section of Oregon, there aren't any of the talking ATMs.
Right.
And unfortunately, they don't even have Braille on them. But you do have to memorize the prompts and know from there, you know, what to do.
So this point of sale gig, this is where, for example, you can go into a store, and you make your purchase and you hand over your card to them and they give you a little keypad and you type in your PIN and the money's debited. Is that how it works?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's how we've got it too, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the way they do it. And you just go and you type in your PIN number. And then if you want some cash, you can say, well, I want $40 out or 60. And a lot of times, of course, it will depend on the merchants. Now, some merchants will not let you take any money back.
Yeah, they're not compelled to here either.
Right, but what they will do is that normally, when at least it's been my experience, that when they don't allow you to take money, there are institutions, like ATMs that are nearby that you can go and get money back. What I think is the most interesting thing is I've gotten a lot of new bills. And you can smell the ink.
Lovely smell, isn't it? Don't you think it's nice when you get crisp new notes in your hand?
Oh, exactly.
Oh,
of course,
man.
The only bad thing is that they can stick together.
Oh.
They kind of stick together, so if you're not careful, you could hand someone two bills instead of one. So you have to really be careful to separate them.
Because your currency is still made out of paper, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
We've gone to a plastic currency here, very thick, indestructible plastic, so that even when the notes have been in circulation for a few months, they're not all sort of flaky and all over the place. But you raise another question that I'd like to get your view on, and that is, how accessible do you find your currency to be?
Well, I don't have too much of a problem, but I'm one of these people, I think it reminds me of you because of the fact that, every new gadget that comes out, you have to kind of, try it and test it out. And I have what they call a note teller.
Yeah.
And it'll tell you whether you have 10s or 20s or 1s or 5s. And if the bill's not too wrinkled up, you can go and insert the bill and it'll tell you what the currency is.
But why should we need to take these gadgets around with us, man? I mean, surely the currency should be identifiable by touch to everyone.
Oh, yeah. I think, but, sometimes things move more slowly than we'd like.
Oh, don't they, though?
I think sometimes when you get in this sort of thing, there's people are reluctant to change. I mean, people, of course, here we have the problem. They're constantly having to change the bills because with the technology of the computer age,
yes,
and printers, people are going around and counterfeiting them more than they would like.
What we do here in New Zealand,
the Treasury is constantly having to put little threads, little color threads or something in there to make it harder for people to counterfeit the bill.
We have a situation where all of our notes are different sizes, and we've moved to a $1 and $2 coin. All our coins are very easily identifiable, but from $5 notes upwards, they're all different sizes. I still think that's not necessarily the best system, because some people will still need a base note to compare it with, like if you've got a 5, But I understand in Canada, they've gone to a system where, or at least they were proposing a system, I don't know if they ever introduced it, where they had tactile markings on the currency so that you were supposed to be able to identify the currency
by
touch.
I've heard of that.
Yeah. And somebody said to me, yeah, but it doesn't work because the tactile things rub off. And I think in Holland as well, the guilder is identified. Oh, mind you, they haven't got that anymore, have they? They've gone to
the
euro.
No, it's all euro now.
Yeah. But if anyone is listening from Canada, I'd be really interested, or who's had experience with the Canadian currency, I'd be interested in finding out how accessible that currency is if it's been phased in.
Well, you remind me of something very interesting what happened years ago. We had the, I don't know if you remember hearing about the Susan B. Anthony coin. There was a Susan B. Anthony dollar, and it was a dollar coin, but people had trouble with it because they were about the size of our United, well, they were a little bit small, I forget whether they were smaller or bigger, but they were a little bit different size than what our quarter would be, and that's a 25 cent piece.
Yep.
And people had trouble with that, so that coin did not go over too big, so they discontinued its use.
when I was a kid, I used to collect coins, and I had a couple of different silver dollars from the U.S. I seem to recall having a really, they were quite large coins.
They were.
What were they
and
about?
It was really great when you had, you know, you really felt like you had some real money, even if you had a couple of those silver dollars. And my late father, he collected the dollars and, you know, silver dollars. He had amassed quite a collection for a while, of course. And anyway, it was very interesting to see that those coins, because, of course, now they have dollar coins, or at least they used to, but they just don't have, the silver content is much less than it used to be. It just doesn't have the same ring to it. I mean, you drop it on a hardwood, not a hardwood, but a regular tile floor, but it used to sound great.
They were heavy. They were heavy, and you could spin them, man. They had a great spin
oh, yeah.
on them. There. Yeah, you can imagine all these spin doctors growing up with their silver dollar collections, spinning all day long.
Well, and I think I'd rather not. But, I find this sort of a whole thing of interest to hear the different situations in different countries. Like you were interviewing the woman from Australia today.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to do a lot more of that.
I found that to be very interesting.
Yeah.
To hear the differences in the way things are going there versus the way things are going in other parts of the world.
We are going to do heaps of that in the next little while, talking to some people from some fascinating countries. You know, not just the traditional Western ones, but also people all over the world that I've come into contact with through the World Blind Union and who I think would be of interest to blind line listeners.
Well, what kind of response have you had, I mean, when you've asked people to come on with you like that?
Oh, always very favorable. People are happy to come on and chat about blindness. Sometimes, depending on the country, you have to be a bit careful. Like if you're talking to somebody from a more authoritarian government, you wouldn't expect the person to be overly critical of the government or what's going on there. So you just have to bear those things in mind.
Oh, of course, of course. Well, you know, it's interesting nonetheless, and to see how the different kinds of, maybe it was just fascinating listening to that.
Well, it's always nice to hear your voice again, Stan, and wish us luck at the Oscars tonight, because New Zealand should scoop the pool, hopefully.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, a little sneak preview there, though, that A Beautiful Mind has won one already.
Oh, do you know which one?
The supporting actress.
Oh, interesting. So
I
Russell.
Forget what her name was, but there was a supporting actress that won on that. And by the way, one other thing I wanted to bring up to you, I don't know if you've been following the story, there's going to be a global positioning unit that's going to be available for purchase for the Braille Note.
Yes. Yes, there is. And there's quite a few interesting things. In fact, if anyone's listening who's been to CSUN, give us a ring. And but also Vigitech, I think that's the name of the company, who are involved in the Victor players for DAISY, have also released a CE device that will run on any CE-compatible note taker, which will, or PDA. So, in other words, you can just go up and pick a regular PDA up from the store and put the self-voicing application in, and that will do GPS as well.
Interesting. I think we're in for a very interesting time coming up.
Oh, man, you are. I mean, you wait till you hear about the new Freedom Scientific Note Taker.
I don't need to hear about that.
Oh, no,
you'll buy it. Never mind.
You'll want to hear about it. You'll want to hear about it. It's, yeah. Anyway, hopefully, we hope to have something about that on this week's main menu if we can manage it.
Oh, boy.
You'll want to hear about it. Okay, man. See you later. He's gone off in a huff now, trying to save his pennies. Area code 760. Hi there.
Hello there.
Hi.
This is Paul.
Hello, Paul. How's it going?
It's going okay out here. Got a couple of things for you, the topic of conversation.
Yep.
First of all, I don't have much experience in the foreign currency bit, but I do know quite a bit about the ATM situation here.
Oh, cool.
I do bank at Bank of America myself, and I'm using the brailled ATM machines. The print seems to be rather large. They don't have them talking, I guess, or either that, or I don't know what the plug is on it, but I suspect it's not talking. But we do have the large print display. It seems pretty big. And the neat part about First of all, they give you plenty of leeway if you need to make a deposit or what have you. If you run behind, you need to run in and grab a deposit.
Mm.
You can put one in. But the nice part is that I have what they call an ATM debit card, which functions as a Visa and an ATM card. So wherever Visa card is accepted, you can slide a card at a business that accepts Visa. Whether it's a business, it could be even a place where you order blindness products. It could be any of those places. You can go on the web and order things, and then it deducts the money from your account when you enter all the necessary information in. Of course, the only drawback to this whole system is, first it debits the account and it subtracts it from your total, and then when it comes to like midnight or the next day, it puts it back in the account, and then another day and a half or so, the actual paperwork goes through and it's deducted at that point.
Wow.
You got to be careful with your balance and make sure you don't overdraw.
Why can't it just sort of instantly zap it from one to the other?
I really don't honestly know, but I know that that's what I run into. Some businesses are faster than others. Some of them, basically, it's, bada bing, bada boom, you've paid the bill, and it's instantly done. And sometimes, sometimes it takes, two or three days. It depends on how they do it. Some of them process all the payments in one big batch, and some of them process each little payment at a time. A website will definitely go through and verify that you have the funds, and then in most cases, within about a day and a half, if they're real automated, it'll go right out of the account.
Well, you definitely want to get on to Bank of America, because they do have talking ATMs. At the ACB convention last year, Bank of America was very proudly displaying one, and I think they've been leaders in that area. So either it's got a socket that you haven't found, or maybe you should see if you can get your one upgraded.
Yeah, there you go. That's the right idea. Yeah, because I do take the public transit and things around here in San Marcos and San Diego County, actually, and do quite a bit of travel. So it's nice to be able to go over to a machine and be able to hit the specific buttons. And it would be nice to, it's not a big deal to remember to bring along an earplug of some sort and be able to plug in and maybe hear some confirmation.
That's right, because, I did what you used to do. No, I used to do what you do. And when I was working in an office building in New Zealand's capital, and I'd wander off and go to the ATM and put my card in and memorize the prompts, because, if you want to get $50, it's not that hard. But then what would happen, of course, is that there'd be some prompt that would come up and say the system is down for maintenance, and press the cancel key to retrieve your card. And, of course, I wouldn't see that, and I was wondering why, firstly, nothing was happening, and then the machine had just swallowed my card, and I had to go back and go into the bank and get my card back.
Well, unfortunately, the way it works, if you do have that happen, you don't just get your card back. You have to get reissued a new one. That takes a couple of weeks, but I luckily have a little bit of sight, so I'm able to pull it off, and I'm able to see. It won't even take the card if the machine's broken. So if you go up to it, you could slide the card in all you want to, but it's not going to go in the slot if it's broken.
But what often happens, though, is that there's a problem somewhere further down the network. So as far as
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because so the ATM, as far as it's concerned, it's online. But then when it logs on, it finds it can't log on.
That's true. Wow. Very, very true.
Hate that.
Like I said, these new Versatel Visas, they've got all the major card manufacturers have the little logos. You can get it on any of them. You can get the Master. If you want MasterCard, you can get that particular put on your card. Now, of course, it's not a Visa MasterCard, so you can't just spend and pay a little bit each month. If you spend it, you bought it.
And yep, that's it.
That's a done deal. So.
Yeah.
But it sure has made life a lot easier for those of us that are vision impaired.
Oh, yeah.
Because we can definitely, we don't have to go write those big, checks to whatever agencies we're paying for our software support. And we can just go with the internet in general has opened up a world of possibilities. I don't think I've had as much access to content before I went over to the internet and started doing some of that stuff. So anyway, keep up the good work. And the good part, I do listen to your show every week.
Oh, very good of you to call, because I don't think you've called the program before.
Never have called the program. I've listened tons. I've heard your segments on... I was doing some work for ACB last week and was able to listen in to the talk about the debate there with the blind person who had a kid unwantedly.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, was getting compensated the big digits to do that. My wife and I were outraged, being that we're both legally blind and we both have... And, of course, we've got a 7-year-old together. And we take care of, he's also got a sight impairment and so, and also hearing impairment. And so we take care of him without any problem at all. It's been a struggle at some points, but it's not an independence issue. I struggle more in the effects of where to live and that kind of junk.
Yeah.
The independent stuff that we deal with was long dealt with when we were younger. We were encouraged in school with proper rehabilitation and some of those services.
Well, I certainly hope that person gets some help over in the UK because clearly, you know, there's an issue there.
Yeah, it does send kind of a signal to people. You know, it doesn't represent blind folks very well. But in any event, I think we're making strides. I mean, there's not many folks that have had quite the accomplishments that we have done. And of course, I'm one of the more outgoing folks. I'm the last one to sign up for the programs and the first one to try and endeavor it without. Some of the efforts in some cases, because I think we deserve a little bit better than what sometimes is represented.
Well, keep up all the great work, and I certainly appreciate all your help. And we're running the second week of the new look ACB Radio Treasure Trove as of today, so it seems to be going well.
Yeah, actually, you're actually running continuous promos for ACB Radio right now.
I'll have to check.
An email on it.
I'll have to check that. Thanks for letting me know. I'll check it as soon as I get off the air.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, see you later. Bye. Oh, that's nice, isn't it? Always something going on. Never a dull moment at ACB Radio, where it's 29 minutes away from 3 Universal Time, and we're taking calls from people who haven't phoned the program for the last month or more, and we're delighted to hear from you. And also, if you've never called the program before, like Paul, particularly pleased to hear from you, but also nice to hear from people who haven't spoken to us for a wee while too. The board is free right now, and so you can get in touch with us and get straight on the air without any long distance wait. 1-212-812-2800 is the number. Area code 212-812-2800 is the number. And when you're asked to enter a conference code, it's courtesy of spiderphone.com, 0480-5512. 0480-5512. So to those of you who phoned, emailed me over the months and said, we need something to get some new voices. This is Put Up Time. Give us a call and get on the air because the board is free and we'll be delighted to hear from you. Had a great weekend, actually. Went away to a very touristy place, very touristy, called Rotorua, which is sort of in the centre of the North Island. Well, sort of a bit north, really, but it's a lovely place. Very commercialised these days, though. Pay the big bucks to get into all the venues. And Rotorua is very famous for its boiling mud, all this geothermal, very hot mud and things boiling out of the ground in places. And it's smelly. It really is. I mean, there's no polite way to put it. It stinks, man. But there's lots to do, including going up on this gondola all the way up this huge hill to this venue where they have a whole lot of sideshow attractions going on. And one of the things that you can do there is to get on a swing. Doesn't sound very exciting, does it? But this swing is no ordinary swing. It swings you 240 metres up in the sky. That's a huge height. 240 metres, what would that be? About 600 feet up into the sky. And you sit up there, sort of suspended, and you push a lever. When you push the lever, all the things that are holding you up there get released, and you swing, and you suddenly accelerate to about 150 kilometres an hour, and you're moving. You're rocking and rolling on this thing. It was a great adrenaline rush. And if I paid $15, I could have got a videotape of myself doing it, which was really amazing. I mean, it was well mic'd and everything. Had I known quite how good the microphone was and that it was a camera right above you, I would have given a running commentary and bought the video and put it on the Mosin Explosion, but I wasn't aware of it and I wasn't going to pay $30 just to go on it again. I mean, I like the ACB radio listeners, but I'm not going to pay another $30. So we had a great time in Rotorua and had lots of fun things. So the board is free, and if you want to give us a call, well, that will be good. Area code 212-812-2800 is how you get in touch. Looking for callers who haven't given us a ring in the last month or so. And if you'd like to call, you'll get straight on. Area code 212-812-2800, and then when you're asked to enter a conference code, 0480-5512 is the number, 0480-5512 for the conference call. If you've just joined us, well, we've been talking about accessible money during the open forum part of the program. We began with an interview with Marianne Diamond from Blind Citizens Australia, but we're talking accessible money and how you access your money. We've spoken about automatic teller machines and the fact that some of them do talk and they're out there. There are now in the US, for example, 2,000, about 2,500, I think, Lainey said last week, talking ATMs in 30 states. So there's certainly progress being made on that score. And we've talked about accessing the currency. Do you think that currencies need to be more accessible? I read, in fact, in news notes from the National Office that Charlie Crawford puts out every week, a really good read. Doesn't take long, probably 2 or 3 minutes a week, and you get a bit of an overview about some of the things that are happening and being worked on by ACB. And Charlie mentioned in his news notes this week that the ACB is going to be doing some work on the question of accessible currency. Wouldn't it be good? You see, I was interested when this came up in the Canadian context, and I was over there in 1998 and they were looking at it, and the CNIB made a decision that they were going to advocate for accessible currency, you know, textually accessible, so they had quite distinct markings on the currency, but not Braille. And I was a bit disappointed by that. Obviously, I'm not Canadian, and so it's no direct concern of mine, but I would like to think that that would be such a good advertisement for Braille if you could get durable, prominent Braille on currency. It would promote the use of the medium. It wouldn't take much for people who needed the textually identifiable currency to learn the numbers, and you'd be up and running. And it would certainly promote the message that Braille is still the primary form of literacy for blind people. Good stuff. Do you reckon we should have Braille on our notes? Give us a ring and let us know what you think about the question of accessible currency. Or are we asking too much? Of course, this is the alternative view. You may be someone who subscribes to that view. Should we, in fact, take a bit of responsibility and simply make sure that we use alternative techniques to identify currency ourselves by folding it appropriately, keeping it in separate compartments, whatever it takes? Is making the currency accessible an unreasonable accommodation? If you're inclined, by all means, give us a call, because the board is free and you'll get straight through. Area code 212-812-2800 is what you ring. Area code 212-812-2800, and then when you're asked for a conference code, look at that, there's the other line going. 0480-5512 is that conference code, 0480-5512. Also, if you've been to CSUN, presumably people are back from there, are they? How did that go? Any devices that intrigued you? Everybody's going to be talking about the Freedom Scientific notes, PDA. It's not a note taker, it's a PDA, no doubt. And, of course, the GPS product from the Braille Note. I understand the Braille Note people were also demonstrating their web browser for the Braille Note. Yeehaw! And another GPS product out there. There has been a little bit of CSUN coverage on the ACB Radio Newsroom, and in case you haven't caught up with those details, what we've done is change the front page of the ACB Radio website so that you now get blindness-related news instead of just general current affairs type news. So if you're interested in what's going on in the blindness world and you would like to find out about what's happening, then you get a pretty good selection of news from the ACB Radio Newsroom, www.acbradio.org. Let's play some music, I think, because I'm not going to waffle forever. And let's just do a double check to make sure we haven't had any calls coming up the last minute so we don't keep them waiting. Nope. So let's hear some Albert Hammond, and if you'd like to give us a call, then you can do that during the track and we'll put you straight to air afterwards. Area code 212-812-2800 is the number. And then when you're asked for a conference code, it's 0480-5512. Thanks to Spiderphone for making that all possible. And here's music from Albert Hammond.
Got on board a westbound 747. Didn't think before deciding what to do. All that talk of opportunities, TV breaks and movies rang true. Seems it never rains in Southern California. Seems I've often heard that kind of talk before. It never rains in California, but girl, don't they warn ya before? Man,
in Southern California. It just pours. Man, it pours. Let's hope that the weather was good for CSUN. Let's go back to the phones. Hi, this is Blind Line.
Hi, Jonathan. Tom Belshon from Phoenix.
How are you?
It's great. How are you?
Excellent, thanks.
Yeah, I just had some comments about the money issue is one thing. You know, that's what I do is fold everything. But I've never seen any of the... Like, I think in Britain, don't they have different sizes of money?
I think so. I can't recall, but I think in Britain and possibly even Australia as well, they may do that as well, yes.
Is there anything in New Zealand? Or?
Yeah, we use different sizes of money for the coins.
That seems to make more sense to me, because you mentioned Braille, but with you know, people having trouble with Braille and older people with the sensitivity going down because of, you know, diabetes and stuff, I would think different sizes probably would be better.
I'd really be interested in hearing from people who can verify that. Because I often hear this from professionals, and I wonder whether it's one of those things where, you know, we hear it often enough and it becomes truth. I mean, how many older people with diabetes really find it difficult to identify a bit of Braille. I mean, we're not talking necessarily about reading full pages, just, for example, differentiating between the numbers 1, 4, 5, and 10.
I've been told, though, you know, I know over here I've seen something called Jumbo Braille.
Yes.
You know, that's been used for people who have, you know, trouble sensing it. But I've had some friends that had, you know, diabetic retinopathy, and they had said, yeah, well, we can't read it because, you know, our sensation is gone in our fingers. So.
But then would anything, yes, maybe it's a question of both then, because, see, I find the size issue not that helpful, because you still have to have a base note to compare it with. Like the 5 is slightly shorter than the 10, which is slightly shorter than the 20, but if you don't have a base note to compare it with, that you know what it is in the first place, they're not that different in size that I don't think many people could identify them individually. So maybe we need different size notes and tactile identification.
Yeah, a few years back at one of the ACB National Conventions, they had a note identification system that they had, but you had a little device that you stuck the note in, and it had different holes at different values, you know, in the bill, so that you could tell what the bill was. And I don't know whatever happened to that, you know.
Yes, we have that kind of device in New Zealand. Well, it's not even. It's a bit rich calling it a device, really. It's just this sort of gauge thing that we have here. Because our currency are different sizes, you can just get a gauge where you can measure what currency you're dealing with. Now, Stan, who called earlier from Oregon, and I didn't really pursue this with him and probably should have, made the comment that he's got a high-tech new device that he takes with him. I think he said it was called a note teller, and it identifies currency.
Yeah, I've seen that it talked about on some of the lists, but never read them too close, you know.
Do you know how they work?
I have no idea, but I thought they used, you know, some of the blind vendors used a device like that.
Okay. Maybe somebody who's in that area will tell us.
To call in.
Yeah, that'd be really good. There's also programs, of course, that work with your scanner. I know that. I think both Kurzweil 1000 and an open book have a scan currency feature that works in the U.S.
Yeah, I've seen on the list, you know, people talk about those, and that, you know, you can go out and download it from their websites and stuff.
Yeah, I think Kurzweil gives it away, and if you do already have Kurzweil 1000, it's right there on the scan menu. Just choose recognize currency, and it does. But doesn't recognize our currency.
Well, you've already got size differential.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So you, isn't it a matter of principle, though, you know, of human rights, that the currency should be accessible to everybody? If it's good enough for a sighted person to just glance at the thing and see what they're holding in their hands, then we should be able to do the same thing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, definitely. I know I've been, you know, gotten bills back, and I remember one time, you know, taking a cab, and you give the guy the money, and then you give a tip, and I realized after I had left the vehicle that instead of giving them, you know, a couple bucks, it was a 20 and a 1.
Oh, man.
You know, so that type of thing, you know, those happen, you know.
Yeah, and even worse than that, although you'd hope that any good taxi driver would say, look, that's a 20 you gave me, did you really mean to tip that much, and it's very generous of you, sort of thing. But what's even worse than that, I think, is when somebody gives you change and tells you that they're handing over a $10 note when they're handing over a 1 or something.
Yeah, that whenever I get change, I never put it in my wallet folded. I always stuff it in my pocket, and then when I get to my wife, I'll let her tell me what they are, and then I fold them and put them away.
Yeah, you have to. But then it's only then that you realize you've been shortchanged.
Yeah.
Rude. It's what they call robbing you blind, man. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you calling in, and good to hear from you.
Well, your listeners, too, to listen on Monday nights. Those guys are doing a great job.
Yeah, aren't they, though?
Yeah.
They're doing a great job.
Yeah, Jim is doing a great job there, too. I'm sort of happy that they're their use of spider phone was technically beyond their capabilities, because when they leave it open like that, it works out real well.
Yes, well, I don't know what the issue is there. I mean, it works well every time for me, but...
Well, as I said, slightly beyond their technical capabilities.
Yeah. No, they do a fine job, and, you know, it gives a different flavor to it, too.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, well, we'll see you in Houston.
We'll look forward to it very much.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Yes, Houston is coming. It's only 3 months away, isn't it? 3 months away. We'll be in Houston bringing you coverage of the convention on ACB Radio Mainstream and hopefully other things besides. So we'll keep you posted as soon as we know what's going on. Now, you see, the board is free again, so area code 212-812-2800 is the number if you'd like to give us a ring. Area code 212-812-2800. We've probably got time for a couple more calls should they come in. When spiderphone.com asks you for a conference code, it's 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. And it will be great to hear from you. One of the things that Marianne Diamond mentioned, and it has come up on the ACBL list just recently, is the question of who controls blindness-related organisations. And in New Zealand, we have a very similar policy to the Australian one, which is that only blind people can vote and move resolutions and all of those things, that sighted people are welcome as associate members, but they don't have voting rights. They can speak at the discretion of the chairman, but they don't vote. And it was a really great discussion that went on the ACBL list over this. Some people saying, well, that's exclusionary and discriminatory, and other people saying, well, no, it ain't. If it's a blindness organisation, it has to be controlled by blind people. I wonder, for example, what the NAACP does. I mean, if you're white, can you just walk in and join up and vote? I don't know. If you've got any thoughts on that, in terms of the merits or otherwise of sighted people voting in consumer organisations of the blind, well, that'd be an interesting thing to raise at this late stage of the programme. Anything else on your mind as well, area code 212-812-2800, and then the conference code of 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. And as I was just mentioning with that previous caller, we have got Dennis Miller along with Miller Time on Tuesday UTC, that's Monday evening in the United States, and then Mike Bullis and the Snowman along with Sound Off. So no doubt that will be a fascinating program as always here on ACB Radio Mainstream. Next week is Easter and we won't be doing a blind line then, taking a couple of days off. Got to do that from time to time, you know. And so we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time, and we'll hopefully have some more interesting chat. We've got a couple of possibilities lined up that I think, whichever one comes to fruition, you're going to love it. You're going to love it. And then we'll get back to our open forum. So at that point, I think we'll call it a day and play another track to take us out. Look forward to having your company in 2 weeks' time for Blind Line. I hope that you have a wonderful Easter. If you're having a bit of a break, enjoy it. And we'll go out with some music from Firefall. Thanks to our guest, Marianne Diamond, and to those people who called in. Bye for now.
It's not the things you from the start. I saw your face, and that's the last